and welcome to probably the last special episode of Football Memories and Moments. You know, in Family Guy, when they did the Star Wars and the first two were great, and then they obviously got very tired towards the third one. It has that feel, but it is the best of series one. We've started it, so we may as well finish it. And this was really the series that kicked it all off. People in this series who really did me a favour in giving me their time, specifically Ian McIntosh, Jim Proudfoot, Simon Hughes, who were all exceptionally busy. And it was some great stories in this series as well, with Dan Storey talking about his love of Brian Clough and also Ronaldo, which was great. One of my favourite parts was Adam Hurry, his love for Barry Davis, Antonio Yeboah's goal in Wimbledon. And it was great to hear from David Priest and James Montague, who told us a great story about being in prison on the day of England versus Spain. So I'll leave that for you to have a listen to. And again, if you listen to us on Apple Podcasts, please rate us five stars or whatever stars. Just give us a rating and get us up those charts if you could. All right, enjoy.
So he basically gave me a choice, because we lived in Chelmsford. And I had drifted, you see, I drifted to the dark side, because like anyone else in the home counties with a television in the 80s, the only football I'd really seen was Liverpool, because the only team that was ever televised was Liverpool and whoever Liverpool were playing. So I drifted down that direction, and he said, you've got straight choice, Colchester or Southend, which I think in the history of straight choices has to be the worst. Yeah, yeah. There is no right answer there. But I took Southend because it was near the seaside. And the game was Southend Huddersfield, and Southend at the time I think were top of the third division, and Huddersfield were like 18th, and it was January, and it was in that stage of the season where, like, if you're 18th in January, they were just high enough above the relegation zone for that not to be a worry, and miles off the chase for anything better than that. So I mean, you would have put this down as your home win banker. Were accumulators a thing in 1991, this would have been the one that you'd have based the entire weekend on.
So let's set the scene. I've been to Route Hall. I went to Southend Tranmere about 18 years ago. It's a lovely little compact ground, if I remember rightly.
It's certainly a unique fixer-upper opportunity.
I've also been to Southend in the winter. It's not the warmest.
No.
So, and how old were you at the time?
I think I must have been about 12. And it was weird. I think most people might go to grander stadiums and have this point of entry, which is them walking up like eight flights of steps and then out for a tunnel, and this glorious sparkling arena opens up in front of them. For me, it was the turnstile, and then I would say about 12, 14 flat concrete steps. Which were already beginning to drip with piss. The waft of fried onions and booze and piss in your face. And at that time, it was the home fans were in the North Bank, and you all know the North Bank is kind of very overhanging, corrugated iron kind of roof, and it's dark and cavernous. And so that was it. It was like up the steps, and of course it's a grey day, it's overcast, and then that green and quite a lot brown pitch opens up in front of you, and it does, it just sort of, it's such a cliche now, but it really does make you go, oh.
All I was really worried about was, because Rock Park was being knocked down, all I was worried about was what I got taken from the ground, keeping myself. So it's kind of like, so I end up taking, what the two things I really wanted was the peg that I'd used for best part of 6 years, while getting changed every year, which I took that down. And the other bit, I desperately wanted a couple of bricks from outside of the main entrance, the players' entrance at Rock Park, because from my youth team playing days there, so there was a bit of graffiti scrawled about, I don't know, 10 foot up the wall, saying David Priest is lush. So I wanted to when they were knocking that down, I wanted it sort of like almost like a mini Banksy.
Yeah.
It was obviously you.
Did you write that yourself?
Do you know what? No, I didn't. But I think it was because it was so high, and the walls never got painted, they weren't even bothered about it. So it stood up there for like five or six years. So every time, I mean, even if I was feeling down, or I spent a couple of, best part of two seasons injured, the last two seasons I was there. So even though it was a tough time and end up being miserable for most of it, every time I walked in the chair the next morning, it was, put a smile on my face. Anyway.
Where is it now? Do you still have the did you get the brick?
No, I didn't. No, they just, it's a housing estate now.
Oh, and, no.
Yeah, so they knocked that down pretty quickly, like, you know. But it was, so it was, and for me, I already knew that I was leaving the club.
Right.
So I'd already had the meeting with Peter Reid, where he'd explained sort of kind of, I'd been injured for the best part of 2 years, brought me on twice in the same place, and it was that second season after I'd had an operation on it, it was kind of, I'd had a steel plate and a metal pin, titanium pin put in my wrist. So I missed about 3 months because of that, and then when I got back for the best part of 6 months, it didn't feel like my hand. It was just totally numb. Every time I played, I strapped it up, so it was like a plastic cast, basically. So I was catching the ball. Pretty much most of my career was a toss up whether I would catch it or not. But particularly at that time, it was kind of difficult for us, like, you know, and my confidence took a hit. So it was. And then the final hit came from Peter Reid, say that even though you're in my contract, I will, you know, looking to move me on, like, you know.
Yeah.
And kind of trying to convince me that would be the best option for me to go. And in the end, it was right.
Yeah.
I end up sort of, before the end of that season, I'd agreed a deal to go to Darlington, sign with James Hodgson at Darlington.
Yeah.
And then, it was all done and dusted. I knew where I was going the next season. And when it came to the game, I was devastated because I thought I would actually start the game.
Yeah.
I think Lionel Perez had went straight back to France, and there was myself and Chris Woods, who had been signed on a short term deal, sort of just before transfer deadline.
We've chosen an incredible scenario, or rather, we've chosen an incredibly difficult goal to describe to a blind person. Because there is just so much going on in it. But what a wonderful case study it would be. So bearing in mind, this is about 2 or 3 weeks, I think, after he scored his very straightforward, in comparison, in relatively speaking, a very straightforward volley against Liverpool. You know, it very uncomplicated. It just plopped out of the sky, and there he was. He just belted it in off the bar. In comparison, this is like a Hollywood trilogy of films. In comparison, so let's take it from the start. As many kind of wonder goals start off, it came from a just sort of half-hearted clearance. Kenny Cunningham just sort of headed out a sort of loose ball, and Yeboah by this point is about 35 yards out, and he chests it down. And the problem with these sort of goals, in hindsight, it looks like he knew exactly what he wanted to do. So, but at the time, let's give him the benefit of the doubt, he was probably still weighing things up. He controls it with his left knee after that, keeping the ball in the air. And perhaps at that point, we were all thinking, what's he got in mind? He wasn't particularly known for his left foot, although to be honest, it was almost as explosive as his right. But by now, he's 30 yards out, and he's weighed up that left foot volley and decided against it. And instead, he brings the ball back inside onto his right foot, which takes Wimbledon's Alan Reeves completely out of the game with a lovely dummy. So now he's 25 yards out. And this is the moment. It's a bit perhaps similar to George Weah's sort of full length of the pitch run and goal against Verona, which I'm not a fan of. It's that moment of indecision about whether he really meant it. But the ball hits his right knee, and it looks like a bit of a ricochet. And I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt here, because it looks like he moved his right knee to keep that ball on path. So the ball hits him on his right knee and sort of bobbles forward now. And he's just under 25 yards out now. Vinnie Jones is around him. And Vinnie Jones, you can see in the replay from certain angles, looks like he could about just about lunge into one of his kind of late 80s era kind of tackles to absolutely take him out. And even he decides not to, which I think is his greatest contribution to football history in my eyes. And after that, the ball essentially is just sitting there begging to be spanked into the top corner. Every footballer whether it's Tony Yeboah or Tony Hibbert, dreams of the ball just sitting up just off the turf on the half volley. And so there it was, about sort of 23 yards out. He's running onto it at a nice angle, not too straight, and simply puts his boot straight through it. And as you said, Barry Davis, by this point, is instructing us to look at that. And then as the ball flies into the top corner, he is very much instructing us to look at that.
31-0 is a book I wrote that looked into the kind of underdogs of international football trying to qualify for the World Cup finals, most of whom never get there, but have this kind of beautiful desire in the face of adversity to try. And nobody encapsulated that for me more than the American Samoa national team, who the book is named after because they once lost 31-0 to Australia, which is still a world record, although I saw that Australia beat, or an Australia under 19 team just beat Papua New Guinea 30-0 even today. So the Australians are still doing it. And so whilst I was kind of planning the book and planning where I was going, I thought, well, I can't write a book called 31-0 unless I go to American Samoa and cover the American Samoa team. And so I looked into it, had a small advance, most of which got spent trying to get to Samoa, which is different to American Samoa. Samoa is actually a country. American Samoa is kind of a dependency of the United States of America, so they have American citizens there. I found out that they were playing a kind of, one of the things that happened after the 31-0 debacle, if you want to call it that, was that they had pre-qualification tournament, because you couldn't have, because Australia in that tournament had like hammered American, had in qualification hammered American Samoa 31-0. I think they'd broken the world record in the game before as well. So they just, yeah, they were just hammering everybody by like double figures. And for me, I looked into it and had this pre-qualification tournament with four of the worst teams in Oceania, which pretty much makes them the four worst national teams on earth. And they were. I mean, you had American Samoa, who were hosting it, Cook Islands, and Tonga. And so I thought, okay, well, I'll get to Samoa. And Samoa is literally on the other side of the world. You have to cross the international date line. So when I landed, I realized I actually had gained a day. So I landed all flustered. I reckon it took me about a day and a half to get there. It was just four flights, absolute nightmare. I landed in this kind of verdant, very plush, beautiful, Pacific island. And I have a little room, and I go straight away to the motel where I know the American Samoa team are up, look at a station. I kind of emailed them in the FA beforehand, told them I was coming. And they said, oh, no, you can't come because there's a film being made about the team. So you can't come near the team. Well, I mean, fuck it. I mean, I'm just going to turn up and see what can they do.
I left home at, I don't know, about 9 in the morning, and got to Barnet at 11.
That's called making sure, that, isn't it? Just make sure.
I thought I'll be first in the queue. There was another guy that worked for Sky that supported them, and so we'd arranged to meet. We'll see you there at 11:30. Got there, there's no parking around Barnet and the old ground, and found somewhere to park and walked down to the ground, and I couldn't see the end of the front end of the queue, which was a bit worrying. And so you mentally tying up, well, I mean, I think you're probably giving us 1,000. Oh, fine, I'm going to be in, I'll be fine. But I was, I don't know, 150 down in the queue 4 hours before kickoff. They opened the gates at 1:30. So, fortunately, it was a nice day, but we were all queuing and chatting about the game. And obviously, you've kind of played the game over in your mind 100 times by the time you actually get in. 1:30, the gates open, everyone paid their money and then raced. We sort of literally got through the gate and then ran, not really knowing the configuration. They put a temporary stand up for us. So it would normally have been terracing that end, but they put temporary seating. I don't know why, because no one sat down, but there were these sort of temporary green seats, and got great positions behind the goal. The goal where it turned out all the action was, and put two or three rows in the front. So it was perfect. It was great. But this stand filled up quite quickly, and it was obvious there were going to be a lot of people locked out. And you ultimately heard stories about a Barnet fan who'd flown in from Australia. His plane had been delayed for an hour, didn't get in.
You know, he arrived at Forest, and we were in the second division. He arrived at us to rebuild his own career as well as to rebuild us as a club. So yes, that obviously makes it slightly more special. But actually, Clough is one of those people in our area, and Forest fans do hate. You know, I'm not a man that hates football fans; it's just not in my nature. But Forest fans do hate Derby fans, and vice versa. But Clough is a kind of middle ground. There isn't really a one-upmanship about. You know, he did this with us, he did that with you, and he left you to come to us, because everyone's a little bit bigger than that, and time's a bit of a healer on that, and people just see him for who he was. He deserves better than us to kind of nitpick and fight between each other, I think.
Do you think as well, that we're coming to the memory that obviously the day after he died, and you're gonna go on hopefully and explain why you wore this, but the question that's been on my mind is, first of all, I'm going to ask you a two-part question. Is one, did you ever really have a choice in being a Forest fan? And secondly, is that day the pinnacle of the sense of belonging in football? And with those two questions, I hopefully you'll answer them as you then proceed to tell us your memory.
Yeah, I didn't really have a choice but support Forest. My mum was born in the northeast, and my grandfather was... lived in the northeast, and all my mum's family do. My granddad was kind of unusual in that he was a policeman who kind of travelled all over the northeast with his job and didn't actually support one of the teams. He kind of loved football and loved the characters Bob Stokoe and latterly Bobby Robson, but didn't really have an affiliation for a team. But my mum was a Forest fan from living in Nottingham. She started going to the games the year after they won the European Cup, as this idea of travelling around Europe watching Forest, and we got knocked out in the first round. But that was kind of her hooked. That was her hooked, and she took me to my first game when I was four. I got a season ticket at five, and that was about that. And my first season ticket was the penultimate season of Clough. So I saw him at his very end and not particularly pretty times, although obviously heard the stories. And I've said to people before, one really good way of showing what Clough means to this area is that my mum used to threaten me with Brian Clough. That's how it would work. You know, he was a single parent family, and she would say, look, if you do that, Brian Clough will find out. Or if you don't do that, I'll tell Brian Clough. Now, obviously, I was very small at that point, but that's kind of how it was. That's how weirdly close we felt to him, and therefore to the club. So, no, I never really had a choice.
Yeah, I was just terrified, I think. Because, like,
football, like...
yeah, because like I said, I grew up watching, you know, do well. And the Hulier years were great. I remember, some, you know, 2001 and stuff like that. I remember us beating Roma at Anfield, take us through. All those were great, but we'd beating Juventus, and we were playing AC Milan. It was weird for me. It was like, oh, like this must be what it's like with what they've been going on about for years and years. But it was also like I grew up in Skem in Lancashire as well, so I was surrounded by Evertonians, some Manchester United fans who'd obviously been there and done that, and they were just like, you're gonna get battered, and I kind of believed them. I was like, yeah, no, we're not that good. I don't think we're that good. You know, it's great, amazing that we got this far. But I was just scared that we were. It'd come a bit too soon for that side. And I was excited, but I was mainly just thinking, oh, shit. Yeah. this is serious. This, everyone's going to see us. Kind of, you know, if we mess this up, everyone's going to know about it.
It's going to be on the biggest sort of. It is the biggest domestic, club stage, isn't it?
Definitely.
So when the team was named, and from right and remembering, he went with Kuhl.
Yeah, Kuhl started.
Kuhl started, and Cisse came on for him.
Haman came on.
No, because he didn't start Haman, did he? Brought Haman on at half time.
So, that was it. Again, another player who just kind of never really lived up to his billing at Liverpool, Harry Kuhl.
You could just tell from moment one that he was as terrified as I was. He wasn't on it at all.
Well, he'd been carrying injuries, hadn't he? It was interesting. I interviewed Harry Kuehl. I did a Crawley game last week, and it was looking at his figure. You know, I'm not that way inclined, but I was looking at his figure. I couldn't understand how he was ever a pro.
Yeah.
He's tiny.
Oh really?
In his frame. Now he might obviously you know, but it was interesting that he had all those calf injuries. And I was, I was thinking, but still a really great player. Yeah. So when that team was named, how what was it? What was your dad and your granddad feel? I think.
I think there was. I don't remember exactly, but I think there was a lot of talk around. Oh bloody hell, Harry Kuehl starting. They rated, like, this is a perfect example, they rated him up because he was a Liverpool player. Yeah. He was sensible and he kept it on the floor. Yeah. And so they wanted him in the side. And obviously, when you're 3-0 down, you bring him on, it's kind of, anything's a bonus. He could have come on and we could have lost 3-1 and it would have been a plus. So I feel like, but Harry Kuehl just wasn't up to it. And that kind of added to the, like, nerves of, like, we're starting a Champions League finally, and that lad looks well out his depth. Yeah. But there was also the element of we'd got this far playing Biscan and players like that and Jimmy Traore. So
the semi was Scott Carson and goal.
Yeah. So we knew that. We knew who was going to start or who was going to be there or thereabouts. And you look at the team and you go, okay, cool. Yeah, well, we're in Champions League final and we've got Jimmy Traore at the back. Let's see what happens.
Going into Marina, didn't have any expectations really. It was just like kind of something to do on a Saturday, go and watch live football. But what I do remember is when I went in, particularly that Kettering game, if I close my eyes now, I can still remember being right behind the goal, right up against the fence behind the goal. And it was a really like kind of, it was a cold, windy day. And just being like everyone was, it felt like there were thousands of people behind the goal. There probably wasn't. It's just when you're younger and there's a lot of people and a lot of them are taller than you, it feels like, you know, there's you've got no space to move. But I just remember, you know, being right behind the goal and seeing the ball coming towards the goal and almost feeling like you're part of the action. You know, you felt like you were playing a part in the outcome of the result, really. And as I said, you know, Marine had a really good team at that time. They were pushing high in the Northern Premier League. So there was a lot of confidence about the club, you know, that they could go and beat these teams. So when they beat Kettering, you know, it was a big result for the club. And to go and beat Redbridge Forest away, you know, was a sensational result. So they went into the semi-final against Witton Albion, which, you know, I remember this vividly, you know, because it was on, it was the first away game that I went to, I think. And it was on Grand National Day in 1992. And I think the party politics win that year, I think. I might be wrong. I'll have to double check. I'm sure I remember party politics winning that year because the National was on at half time of the game. That's what was the tradition, wasn't it? So, and at that point, I'm pretty certain Marine were 2-0 down to Witton Albion, a team from, well, just outside Northwich. So they were 2-0 down, got the game back and drew 2-2. So I was like, wow, you know, they've got, you know, an away goal. They're probably going to go to Wembley. Let's remember as well, Witten were in the league above again. So it was another team from the league above. 2 weeks later, they played the second leg at College Road and Witten won 4-1. So that was my first, like, kind of sense of real disappointment in football. Yeah. You know, when you're really hoping something's going to happen and it didn't. I hadn't been to Wembley at that point. So, you know, again, Wembley, you know, at that time was such a mysterious place, place of, you know, amazing history, desperate to go to. Never been to Wembley. You know, Liverpool were playing Sunderland around the same time, so it would have been, you know, a great story to have, you know, Liverpool winning the FA Cup and Marine winning the FA Trophy, you know, at that point.